Our study this evening centers around the question of, does God care how we dress? As we go to our closet and we consider the fact of what we're going to wear, and as we look at various times, especially in the spring of the year, when individuals in the world and people in the fashion industry, they are very much concerned and very much interested in what is the fashion this year? What is it going to look like? Does God care about how we dress? And so if we ask that question, one of the things that we do is, well, if God cares about it, then God would have revealed something about it, wouldn't He? We could go to His Word and we would find something in there about something to do with clothing, something to do with apparel and adornment and a dress. And that's exactly what we find. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, the Apostle Paul says, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness. And so with that one passage is really all that we need. With that one passage, and if that was all that we had, with that one passage we know that God cares about how we dress. But in that passage, you'll notice that He said proper or modest clothing. And so that begs the question then that we need to find out, well, what would be proper? What then is modest? I want to suggest to you this evening as we enter into our study that I see, with reference to modesty, I see three issues. I see that there is a nakedness issue that the Scriptures address. I see that there is a lust issue that I believe is addressed in God's Word. And then I see a heart issue that's found in God's Word. And so we're going to look at each one of these issues and strive to figure out what the Bible has to say about that. When it comes to modesty and when it comes to the matter of the nakedness issue, I think first of all, as is the case with most words, we need to define those words. Let's make sure that when I say naked, you think the same thing that I'm thinking. And so we need to be on the same page. When we come to the matter of nakedness, we can use just an English dictionary if you want it. Webster's New College Dictionary says that nakedness is a completely unclothed, bare, or nude is one way in which that word is used. Another way in which that word is used is uncovered or exposed, said of parts of the body. And so parts of the body are unclothed, or parts of the body have no clothing on them. And so we have that idea of that certain part being uncovered, and therefore you could refer to that person as being naked. I remember when we were teaching our children or talking about that, and our kids were just very young. You know, well, you can't wear that. That's not modest, or you're naked. And I remember going through Walmart one time in the shopping cart, and our oldest was about 3 years old, and it was the summertime, and there was a guy that walked by Walmart. I'm not sure how he got into Walmart, but he had no shirt on. And if you know our oldest daughter, she says exactly what she thinks. And she exclaimed, "Mom, that man's naked," just like that. Well, she was right, but I would have preferred her not maybe to have screamed that out in the middle of Walmart. But that's this idea of certain parts of the body being uncovered. You could call that one naked. Say, well, that's the English word. Well, even in the Hebrew, we find this word naked is used. And the Hebrew word from which the word naked is translated also carries with it that same connotation. Strong's definition says that it is nude, either partially or totally naked. So you have a partial nudity, which is referenced naked, and you have a complete nudity. In Genesis chapter 2 and verse 25, you remember that this is Adam and Eve, and the account of them being created by our Heavenly Father. And we are told at the very end of that particular chapter that the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. We know from this context that they had no clothing on whatsoever. There's a reason why I believe that in this context he mentions that, because this is going to be important because of what happens in chapter 3. And the fact that what they do then causes them to have a degree of shame, which immediately causes them to cover up. But the way in which they covered up was very unacceptable to God. And so we'll get to that in just a moment. But at this point in time, they were naked, no clothing whatsoever. Job says in Job chapter 1 and verse 21 that naked he came into this world. The same concept of that is in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 7. Naked we come into this world and thither we shall go. And so we come in with no clothing on. But there's another sense in which it might be used in the word naked. And it may not be the fact that they are completely without any stitch of clothing, but that they are just individuals that don't have the right parts of the body covered. In 1 Samuel chapter 19 and verse 24, it is said that he stripped off his clothes and he too prophesied before Samuel, speaking of Saul, and lay down naked all that day and all that night. And therefore they said, is Saul among the prophets? Most individuals that I consulted on that did not believe that Saul was completely naked, but that he had stripped off his outer garments and therefore had uncovered himself in such a way that would have been a normal. And so by virtue of that, he was considered to be naked. Isaiah chapter 20 and verses 1 through 4, God has Isaiah go through and give a mental, visual picture to the children of Israel and what their life will be like and what God is going to bring upon them, even though they're not listening to the warning. But in Isaiah chapter 20, it says that in the year of the command of the commander of came to Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him, and he fought against Ashdod and captured it. At that time, the Lord spoke through Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saying, go loosen the sackcloth from your hips, take your shoes off your feet. And he did so, going naked and barefoot. Now, he wasn't completely naked, but he had removed some of his clothing, enough of the clothing that he was partially uncovered. And to that extent, it could be said of him that he was naked. When we look into the Greek word, and we find that the word that's used for the Greek, gumnos, which is the word that's translated naked, we find that Thayer says it is unclad, without clothing, ill-clad, or clad in the undergarment only. You see that in Mark chapter 14 and verse 52. Of completely being unclad, as the young man that was in the garden who was watching things go on, that wrapped himself in a blanket, and yet the blanket is grabbed and he runs away and he has no clothing on. Ill-clad in Matthew chapter 25, verses 36 and 38 and 43. And most believe that in that, and this is where Thayer has placed these various words, he said in this particular context, it would appear as though that this use of the Greek word is, you were naked, you saw me naked, and you clothed me. In the sense that I didn't have enough clothing. I was inadequately clothed. And as a result of that, you saw that that was inadequate, and you clothed me. And so it's ill-clad, not completely naked, just ill-clad. And then in John chapter 21 and verse 7, we find clad in the undergarment only for work is what Peter was when he was in the boat, and he sees Jesus on the shore, and he puts his outer garment back on so that he might jump in the water and swim. And here is in John 21 and verse 7, this idea of clad in the undergarment only. Now, Zodiades, it's not just Thayer that says that this word is used in these three different ways. It's also Zodiades in his dictionary New Testament terms. He says the same thing. He says, stark naked. That sounds like something we would say, wouldn't we? And we would recognize, not a stitch of clothing. Or comparatively naked or ill-dressed. In other words, some clothing, but not enough clothing. And then stripped of the outer garment. And so as we look at this just from a definition standpoint, we learn some things about nakedness. We learn that whether we're talking about our English word, the Hebrew word, or the Greek word, all define nakedness as completely unclothed, as well as partially unclothed. And so the Bible says it is a shame to be naked. In Isaiah chapter 2, that was the point that Isaiah was or God was trying to make through Isaiah, is you're not worried about this, you're not concerned about this, but you don't recognize the fact that when the Assyrians come, you will be ashamed because your clothing will be inadequate because you are now a captive and they're not concerned about you being clothed. That's what's coming down the pike for you. In Revelation chapter 3 and verse 18, Jesus looks at the church in Laodicea and says, you think that you are fine, and I'm telling you that you are naked. Now, yes, I recognize that that is a spiritual connotation, that spiritually speaking, that they were naked and that they needed something. But that only works spiritually because it's true physically. And so as a result of that, there's this idea of this nakedness brings shame. So when we think about that, what we come to the conclusion is that partially clothed is still said in God's word to be naked. And it's a shame to be naked. And there's no distinguishing between the shame of partial and complete. And so it's a shame to be naked. So when we think about this, being completely unclothed needs no further explanation, does it? I mean, you can kind of figure that out. But what about partially clothed? How partial is partial? How much is not enough? And that's wherein we have to figure out. Since partially clothed is still considered naked, well, then obviously we need to know what needs to be covered so that I can know that I don't fit that definition of naked. And so there's our question. What needs to be covered to prevent one from being considered naked? So where do we go to find this? Well, Genesis chapter 3 is one of the places that I think we can go in the story of Adam and Eve. And remember, we mentioned that we left Adam and Eve in chapter 2, and we left them being completely unclothed, without any clothing on, and the statement is made that they were not ashamed. But in chapter 3, something is going to change. And you know the story that they sin. And when they sin, verse 7, it says that the eyes of them both were open. They knew that they were naked. Now that's the naked from verse 25 of chapter 2. They knew they had no clothing on whatsoever. Now they recognize that. Yes, I think there is a degree of shame in there because of the sin. And when one has done something that they ought not to do, one naturally, even if they're fully clothed, feel exposed, don't they? You feel naked because of what you've done. But they actually literally were. And so what they attempt to do is they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loin coverings. They heard the sound of the Lord walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and the man and his wife hid themselves in the presence of the Lord among the trees of the garden, verse 8. The Lord God called to the man and said to him, where are you? And he said, well, I heard the sound of you in the garden and I was afraid because I was naked. So I hid myself. I want you to notice that in verse 7, that they recognize that they are naked and that they sewed fig leaves for themselves together. And so now they're covered with fig leaves, but then they hear the voice of the Lord and they still feel like they're naked. We heard your voice, and we hid because we are naked. We jump down to verse 21, and we see that after God has finally confronted them about their sin, given them the curses and the punishment and the consequences of their sin, we are then told that the Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them. In verse 7, we have them being completely unclothed, and so they attempt to clothe themselves. In verse 10, it's partially clothed, but even they acknowledge that they're still naked. In verse 21, it is not till verse 21 that we find them clothed by God, and so we might say divinely designed clothing. But what we need to do is to figure out, well, what is the difference between what they did and what God did? And when you look at these words and you look at the two words that are used here, when you look at the Hebrew word that's used in this text, or you go to the Greek version of this text and look at the Greek word that's used there, you'll look on the left side of the slide and you'll see that the loin coverings that they made was nothing more really than a girdle. Now, it's not the girdle that we might think, but it was more of a belt, more of a loincloth. The Greek word that's used there is actually a compound word that is a combination of around and life. And so it would have been around the reproductive organs of both the male and the female. It would have just covered the midsection. That would have been the loincloth. That's what they covered with their fig leaves. But we find in verse 21 that when God clothed them, that God's clothing was much more significant. In fact, the Hebrew word that's used there is a tunic. Jacinus says in his dictionary of Old Testament words, generally with sleeves, coming down to knees, rarely to the ankles. So you have a clothing that was with sleeves, short or long, some discuss that, with sleeves, and so with sleeves all the way down to at least the knees, and sometimes all the way to the ankles. Well, that's a very different picture of what God did than what they had on, isn't it? God clothed them. In the Septuagint version, the Greek version of this section, the chiton is the word that's used there, and that is a garment covering shoulders to knees or longer. Again, a very different picture is painted for us. And since this is the word that is used, this is the Greek word that's used in reference to nakedness, and since this is what God did himself and said, I will clothe you, then I think it's good for us to make sure that we understand the ramifications of that word. Because this is what God did to clothe them. And so you look at some of the various references that you might look at. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, the original edition, says that this resembled the Roman tunic corresponding most nearly to our long shirt, reaching below the knee always, and in case it was designed for dress occasions, reaching almost to the ground. Later says of this word that when this word is used of peasantry, it was shorter, like the modern cami or the Syrian fella, which is to the knee. Again, we've got it where? Well, we've got it from the shoulders to the knee, at the very least, is what this word says. We go to the Cambridge commentary, and it says the word coats, some versions have that coats instead of covering, the word coats hardly represents the Hebrew so well as the Septuagint version of this Greek word. And at the very end of that quote, it says that it was a kind of shirt without sleeves reaching down to the knees. When you look at the Davis Dictionary, he says that it usually had short sleeves and reached nearly to the knees, though a longer form with sleeves full length was in use. Wilson's Old Testament word study says it was a tunic worn next to the skin, generally with sleeves to the knees, but seldom to the ankles. Now, I give you all of these various references because sometimes, and this has happened to me, sorry, there you go. Forgot to do my clicker. Someone has said, well, you've just used that one reference, and you've just cherry-picked that one reference out because that says what you wanted to say, and you haven't looked at all the other references. And so that's what we've done. We've just looked at Bible dictionaries. We have looked at commentaries. We have looked at lexicons. And they all consistently say it is a garment. This word always talked about a garment that was from the shoulders with sleeves to the knees, below the knees, sometimes all the way to the ankle. And so that's what God did when he clothed them. So there are some conclusions that we can draw. God intends for the majority of our bodies to be covered. Secondly, if I'm wearing clothing which exposes that which should be covered, then that clothing is immodest. And according to the definition of the word naked, I would be considered naked. To be clothed, I must have a garment, at the very least, which covers from head to knees. Now notice I said at the very least, which covers from head to the knees. Wearing modest clothing, however, we need to think about this, doesn't mean one's nakedness can't be exposed. I may have modest clothing on, but I still might get myself in a situation where because my clothing is pushing the bounds of modesty and nakedness, I may find myself actually exposing parts of the body that ought not to be exposed. In Exodus chapter 20 and verse 26, the Lord gave the garments for the priest that he wanted them to wear. And then he gives them the stipulation that when you build the altar must not be high or tall, lest you expose your nakedness. Now their clothing was modest because God gave them that clothing. This is what you wear. But they could get themselves in a situation, in a place. Yes, I think he's talking about idolatry in the big high temples. But the point nevertheless stands that if you build these big high temples, one of the dangers of doing that isn't just the problem of idolatry, but it's a problem of exposure. And you would expose parts of the body that are not meant to be exposed. Think about this from the standpoint of a modest blouse until one bends over. And then one has exposed parts of the body that ought not to be exposed. Or a modest dress that catches the wind easily. Or modest till you're sitting on an elevated stage and at a concert or a play or something. And then you're kind of in the same situation as Exodus chapter 20. Or modest dress when standing, but immodest when seated. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't wear a dress that doesn't get caught in the wind. And I'm not saying that at times there are times that we might turn or we might do something that we unexpectedly expose something. What I am saying is that we had to be aware of that. And we had to be aware of the fact that we don't say, well, I'm dressed modestly. You may be dressed modestly, but you need to be aware of the movements that you might make that might expose parts of the body that God meant to be covered. And so we ask some questions. Does my clothing expose the parts of my body God desires to be covered? Now, we've given references and lexicons and dictionaries, and we know what that word means. So we know what God did. We know the extent to which He covered Adam and Eve. Does my clothing expose the parts of my body God desires to be covered? Am I aware of exposing parts of my body when bending over or raising arms or crossing legs or whatever position you want to consider? Am I aware of the fact that I might be doing this? I need to be aware and cognizant of that. And then should clothing be worn in which I run the risk of exposing what God intends to be covered? Well, I'm modest if I'm standing. Well, then stand all day long. But when I sit down, well, I can't help it that that happens. Why are you pushing your clothing right to the limit of what's acceptable? Be careful. We'll have more to say about that in just a minute. And so I would suggest to you that that's our first issue in the matter of modesty. And that is the matter of the naked issue. But there's a lust issue that we have to address when it comes to the matter of modesty as well. When we think about this lust issue, I want you to consider that a woman may be modest from a nakedness standpoint, meaning that what needs to be covered is covered. But there comes a question but how is it covered? You may have the parts of the body covered that needs to be covered, but how is that covered? A woman may be modest from a nakedness standpoint, but her clothing may be sexually attractive clothing, which promotes lust and thus would be considered quite immodest. It has become such a fashion statement and fad that yoga pants and running pants and LuLaRoe leggings, that these things are worn as pants. That's it. And women won't even attempt to cover up the fact that these are leggings. They won't attempt to wear dresses that would be modest and would be an appropriate cover. They see them as pants. But not just that. Tight or thin garments which reveal the outline of, or one can visibly see one's undergarments, covered, yes, but thinly or tightly. That raises another issue. And that's why someone might say, well, but I'm covered according to your nakedness issue. That's why I say, well, that's only one aspect of the matter of modesty. The other aspect of that is, okay, you may be covered, but you may be covered in a sexually attractive way. And if so, that raises the second issue of lust. Are you creating lust? When we think about this, Alan Auerbach said in General Psychology magazine a few years back, he says, it is our culture that teaches females to exploit their looks. It's a Western notion that women, doesn't matter if they're married or not, need to appear sexually attractive to other men in order to have self-worth. It's a big part of the source of their power. Women don't feel like true women unless other men find them sexually attractive. This is what fuels the age-defying makeup industry, plastic surgeons, and the fashion world. Men display their wealth, power, and status, while women display their appearance and sexual appeal. Many women find that it is the only thing they have going for them. A woman's instinct for display is as strong as a man's instinct to look. Now, here is someone who's not a Christian. He's not even addressing the subject of modesty. He's just looking at the nature of women and men, and he's saying, look, this is the nature of women. This is the nature of men. And even more so in our Western culture, we have a cultured, sexualized kind of atmosphere in which the only way that a woman can feel good about herself and that she is worth something is if her rating on the sexual meter or the lust meter is high. We need to understand something, that men are visually stimulated. I don't know if you know this, but men and women are different. They think differently. They look at things differently. And men are a much more, though women can be too, men are much more visually stimulated. Men are more quickly led to lust than women over this visual stimulation. That may be the very reason why in Matthew chapter 5 and verses 27 through 30, you have this statement, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that whoever looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Some might say, well, he was talking to his disciples. He was talking to a group of men. And so that's why he addresses it to the men. And that's a good point. But it's interesting that in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verses 9 and 10, that when giving the standards by which men and women should address themselves and should live, that the apostle Paul says to the women that they need to dress in modest apparel. Go to 1 Timothy chapter 2 and let's read that passage one more time. Likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair and gold or pearls and costly garments, but rather by means of good works as is proper for women making a claim to godliness. Men are visually stimulated creatures. A woman can dress in a sexually attractive way, which causes a man to struggle with lust. A woman by her dress could be laying down a stumbling block for a man. Let me just refresh your memory about what the Lord thinks about those who might engage in actions that causes one of his children to stumble. Matthew chapter 18. Verses 5 through 7. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, but whoever receives one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble It would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks, for it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come, but woe to that man through whom that stumbling block comes. Most of the time it's at this point that someone will say, well, I can't help that people are going to lust. I could wear a sackcloth and they would still lust. Well, we're not talking about dirty-minded men, because that's certainly the case. That there are some men, regardless of what might be worn or what might be done, just the fact that you are a woman, that's going to elicit impure thoughts in their mind. But we're not talking about dirty-minded men. We're talking about good men striving to live righteously for God, that you might put a stumbling block before them. That's who we're talking about. Aren't you concerned about that? But a lot of times we'll hear this, but I'm not trying to do that. I'm not trying to do that. And to a woman that might state that, I would say, I'm not accusing you of trying to do that. In fact, that may very well be the case, that maybe you're not really trying to do that. Does that change the stumbling block? Does the intention of the woman to be noticed, or I'm not really trying to be noticed? Does the intention of I want them to lust after me, or I'm not really concerned that they lust after me or not, does that change the lust that might well up in the heart of a good-hearted man? Does that change his lust? Does that change the temptation? No. And so the intention isn't really relevant. Let me give you some quotes from a book called The Male Factor. And this was a book that was written by a woman to women about how they needed to dress in the workplace. Again, here's a woman who is not a Christian. She's not addressing the subject really of modesty from a spiritual standpoint. She's just saying women need to be aware of the fact that the way in which they dress causes distractions in board meetings and in meeting rooms where there are men. And a lot of times they aren't even aware of the fact that they're doing that and they don't even intend to do that, but it still happens. Each of us, men or women, probably have individual quirks of our biological wiring that we'd rather not have. Temptations, frustrations, impulses, desires. There are facets of our nature that we would love to be able to just turn off at times. The visual wiring men have presents a similar temptation that men say they often don't want and wish they could turn off, especially in business settings. Their visual nature is highly attuned to and predisposed to take in appealing images, including images of an appealing woman. And if that woman is dressing in a way that emphasizes her assets, that fact is not only noticed, but often begins a train of thought that more men in business would rather not have. But their visual nature isn't something that can be turned off. They must work to ignore it. In talking to men, I found most were incredibly puzzled as to why the woman wouldn't want to avoid the situation. Why, the men wonder, is a professional woman dressing in a way that is likely to cause men to be distracted and miss some of what she's saying? And the answer, of course, is that most women have no intention of causing that sort of distraction and don't realize that they are doing so. To test the difference in men's and women's perceptions in this area, I asked men what they would think if they saw a woman dressing in a way that emphasized or showed off her figure in some way, such as a low-cut top or a tight skirt. Then I asked white-collar women who said they sometimes dressed in that way what was actually going through their minds. Here are the starkly differing results. 76% of the men felt that the woman wanted the men around her to look at her body. Yet only 23% of the women actually felt that way. In other words, 3 out of 4 women said that was not what they were thinking at all. And yet, that's where the mind went. Didn't matter if that was the intention. It wasn't. We didn't mean for that. That's not what we were intending. We didn't dress this way so we would be looked at. But 25% of them, or 75% of them didn't dress that way, and yet 75% of the women felt like, or the men felt like, that's what they were doing. You see, there are differences. What's the conclusion? Intention has nothing to do with sexually attractive clothing, which creates lust. Nothing to do with it. The problem is that women like to look good. Both in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and 1 Peter chapter 3. And in the quote that we gave earlier, women like to look good. And in both of these passages, we'll read 1 Peter chapter 3 in a moment, there is the dress, the physical accoutrements that would go around someone, that I'm going to have a certain kind of hairdo, I'm going to wear fine jewelry, I'm going to wear fine dresses, because I want to look good on the outside. I want to look good. But here's the problem with that. Men like to take a good look. We are a visually stimulated creature. And so here's a woman who likes to look good, and here are men who like to take a good look. And that goes right to the very end of the quote that I gave, that Alan Auerbach gave, that he himself said, a woman's instinct for display is as strong as a man's instinct to look. We have got to make, as men, a covenant with our eyes, as Job did. And not be as some Christians and a good friend of mine who say, well, the first look won't cost you. It costs you. Because even the psychologists acknowledge the fact, and the businesswoman acknowledge the fact, that when a woman dresses in such a way and a man sees that, it causes a train of thought for him, his mind, to go down. Now, if that's in a business application, what about a godly man that's striving to serve God? How many looks does that take for the mind to go down that path? One. And so that's why Job says, I need to make a covenant with my eyes. And so the question then is, well, how should a woman dress so as not to create lust? Well, the first thing that we need to do is women need to recognize that they've conquered the nakedness issue. I mean, the first thing obviously is we ought to go back to the nakedness issue and say, okay, well, do I have everything covered that needs to be covered? And the second thing is, okay, well, what New Testament principles are laid out for me that I might know what God desires for me to wear so that I might not cause lust in the heart of a good-hearted, faithful servant of the Lord? 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. Again, likewise, I want women to adorn themselves with proper clothing, modestly and discreetly, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly garments, but rather by means of good works, as is proper for women making a claim to godliness. Women making a claim to godliness. Here is their profession. They are godly women, and so they want to dress like godly women. So how do godly women dress? Well, they will not dress in such a way that's going to create a stumbling block of lust for a man. They're not going to do that in any way. They will not stress the outward adornment of her body. That's what both of those passages deal with. The woman that says, well, I want to look good. I want to physically look appealing. I want to have all of this because it's about display. Well, that's the very opposite of what God says. A godly woman is not concerned about physical display. That doesn't mean that makeup is wrong. That doesn't mean that she shouldn't shower. That doesn't mean that she shouldn't fix her hair. But that's not her emphasis. Her emphasis isn't on the outside. It's on, as Peter says, we're going to get to in a minute, the hidden person of the heart with a gentle and a quiet spirit. That's what her adornment is. Finally, she will make sure that her works clothing, in other words, is consistent with her profession. Or is it inconsistent? Do I make a claim and yet my clothing would suggest otherwise? That would be hypocrisy. So what are these guidelines that are mentioned in 1 Timothy chapter 2? Well, again, if you go back, I've got them highlighted for you in yellow. If you go back, you'll see that the guidelines revolve around three words: proper clothing, modestly, and discreetly. One fellow said in the commentary that I read, so the first thing then that the women are urged to pay attention to is their dress or apparel. And there are three qualifiers mentioned before apparel: modestly, sensibly, and seemly. So that's what we're trying to find, isn't it? Okay, well, we've got apparel that's got to be put on. We've got to take care of this nakedness issue, but I also want to make sure that the apparel that I put on doesn't create lust. And so there are three qualifiers given for the kind and the nature of apparel that a woman should wear. What are they defined as? Proper clothing, and that this the words that I'm using are coming from the New American Standard. Your version may have something different. Proper clothing is defined as orderly and decent, what Zodiati said. The Theological Dictionary of the New Testament said it describes one who disciplines himself and one who may thus be regarded as generally moral and respectable. Zodiati's in his Dictionary of New Testament Words says the virtue of kosmaios, however, is not only the propriety of his dress and demeanor, but of his inner life uttering and expressing itself outwardly. So, we think about that particular word. Here would then be the application of that one qualifier. Knowing that men are visual creatures, a woman will dress in such a way that is decent, that is morally respectable, and is a reflection of her inner desire to be godly and to help men in their desire to be godly. But there's a second qualifier, and that's the qualifier of modestly. Zodiates again says an innate moral repugnance to a dishonorable act or fashion. Repugnance means it's something that is hated, unpleasant, it's offensive to. They wouldn't dream of doing it. It's repugnant to. And so here's this idea, an innate moral repugnance, hatred, abomination to anything dishonorable. A word that means moderate. That's what the UBS commentary says. Or reasonable, with the implication that the person is aware of what is best in a particular situation. And then R.C. Trench, in his Dictionary of New Testament Words, says it is often said that this word precedes and prevents the shameful act. So here's my conclusion in looking at those definitions. Knowing that men are visual creatures, she will have a moral repugnance to causing a man to struggle with lust. Such a moral repugnance that she will not push the limits of what is reasonable. If something is that repugnant, if you're walking or running on the road and there's a skunk that's been run over, do you get as close to the skunk as you can, or do you stay as far away from it as you can? You get as far away from that as you can. You err on the side of caution. That's what this word means. Of what is reasonable, but will always dress in such a way that will prevent the creation of an opportunity for a shameful desire of lust to arise. The third qualifier is discreetly. Discreetly means having or displaying caution or self-restraint. Sober-mindedness, moderation of desires, passions, or conduct. Zodiates. Again, R.C. Trench said, it is that habitual inner self-government with its constant rein on all the passions and desires which would hinder the temptation to these from arising. And so what's the application of this? Well, knowing that men are visual creatures, she will always use self-restraint and her inner self-government to rein in her own passions regarding the desire to look good. And she will always be cautious and sober-minded in choosing what to wear. And so, we have the issue of nakedness, and we have the lust issue. But I want to suggest to you, this issue solves the other two issues. And that when one has the heart issue figured out, the nakedness issue and the lust issue isn't an issue. It isn't a problem when the heart is right. And so let's look at this matter of the heart. In a very good book by Jeff Pollard, the book entitled Christian Modesty and the Public Undressing of America. He said, modesty is not first an issue of clothing. It is primarily an issue of the heart. And if the heart is right with God, it will govern itself in purity coupled with humility and will express itself modestly. In other words, the nakedness issue and the lust issue never become issues, do they? Because the heart has already handled that. That's the very thing the Apostle Peter said in 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 3 and 4. Your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair, wearing gold jewelry, or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and a quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. Amazing that in the context of adornment, we talk about hidden person of the heart. We talk about a quiet, gentle spirit. We're talking about, on the subject of adornment, we're talking about everything that is within that person. Not what that person has on the outside, but what that person is on the inside. Because what that person on the inside will drive what that person does on the outside. And so we can talk all day long about what you should wear and where the length of your dresses and the tightness of your clothing. But until the heart issue is solved, we will always fight the lines and fight the tightness and fight this. I don't preach on church attendance in Richmond. Not because I don't think it's important, but it's because I don't think that's the problem. The problem is a heart issue. The problem is, why isn't this one here? There's something else going on besides how you need to be here. Well, you know what? They might decide, well, I need to do what Adonis says. He really convicted me. And their heart may just be as rotten to the core as it can be. The children of Israel tried that in Amos chapter 5 and Isaiah chapter 1. They went and they sacrificed and they did everything that God wanted them to do. They didn't miss a festival. And yet God said, I'm tired of listening to it. I'm tired of seeing it. Go away from me. Why? Because their heart wasn't right. And so, when we come to this matter of adornment, we may get modesty figured out. And we may never be guilty of the nakedness issue or the lust issue, but we may do it from the wrong motive and our heart may never be right. And God wants our heart to be right. It's kind of interesting in this context of 1 Peter chapter 3 that really what we're talking about is a woman who has a husband who is not a child of God. How should a woman in a situation wherein she has a husband who is not a Christian, how should she act? Is her goal to convert him or is it to keep him? If her goal is to convert him, then Peter says, then you need to have a certain kind of behavior, and that's respectable and chaste. And your adornment, you're going to have adornment, but your adornment needs to be the adornment that's the hidden person of the heart and a gentle and a quiet spirit. If you're striving to convert him, then that needs to be your emphasis. But if you're just trying to keep him from finding somebody else, because he's not a child of God and he's not going to be bound by the same moral code that you are, than braided hair, golden dresses. What are you trying to do? In Peter's mind, her goal is to try to convert him. And so the questions then that I would ask would be, how would a woman dress if her attitude is submissive and her spirit is gentle and quiet? Will she dress in such a way that attention is drawn to her because of her adornment? If her heart is right, so too will her adornment. It will take care of itself. But it's not just in Peter, in the passage in Peter, that this idea of this inner self-government or this the heart issue is addressed. Paul addresses it too. The same passage in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. But I want you to notice in the three qualifiers that we looked at, notice that in all three of these qualifiers, you have this idea of that which is within is going to control that which is without. In the proper clothing, not only the propriety of his dress and demeanor, but of his inner life. What is his heart? modestly. An innate moral repugnance to a dishonorable act or fashion. An innate moral, there is something in the heart that causes them to be repugnant toward that. It's a heart issue. And then Trench, it's that habitual inner self-government. Even Paul acknowledged the fact that we are dealing with a heart issue. I had a woman tell me one time, well, I want to look good for my man, was her comment. Let me just suggest to you that there's nothing wrong with wanting to, and I'll use her words, I've got some issues with that, but look good for your husband. But the emphasis should be on your attitude, not on your adornment or appearance. And here was my question for her. Are you really wanting to look good for him or for you or for others? Because you see, that goes to the heart issue. What's the motivation in this? And see, in this situation, it became quite obvious that her desire wasn't just to look good for her husband. It was to look good for others. And someone noticed. And as a result of that, she was unfaithful to her husband, and the man that noticed it was unfaithful to his wife. That's why when we ask this question, well, I want to look good for my man, the hairs on my neck stand up, because that's saying, well, now wait, is that the real motivation, or have you fallen back into the Western culture's view of a woman that she's got to look good, she's got to be sexy, and she's got to have men looking at her, and if she's not having that happen, she's not worthy? Is this proper for women making a claim to godliness? Is that the right attitude? Is this consistent with the action of a gentle and a quiet spirit? Let me tell you, husbands, sometimes they want their wives to look good because it strokes their male ego. There is a reason why this woman was attempting to look good, because she had a husband who wanted her to look good. Because it did something for him. It stroked his ego because of that. And gentlemen, we need to understand that what our emphasis has got to be, and what we have got to hold, as Peter says, precious in the sight of God, is that woman who has a gentle and quiet spirit, the hidden person of the heart. That's what we have got to. It's not about our male ego. We've got to have a wife who is of that nature. That's a godly woman. Well, clicker just quit. There we go. Jeff Pollard made this comment in his book. He said, though it is true that one may dress modestly from a sinful and a prideful motive, one cannot knowingly dress lavishly and sensually from a good one. Thus, the purity and the humility of a regenerate heart internally must ultimately express itself by modest clothing externally. And so in this matter of modesty, I would suggest to you that there are three issues involved: a nakedness issue, a lust issue, and a heart issue. But I want to deal with for a moment this matter of, okay, so who should teach this? Who should teach this as these issues? Who should be the one that gets this across to our young women and ladies? Who should teach this? Gary Henry sat down years ago. He talks about this. He sat down beside a prostitute in the place that he was going. And it was obvious that was what her profession was. And so he struck up a conversation with her. And this is just a little bit of the conversation. He said, you know a good bit about men. And she said, it's my business to know. And Gary said, why is it that religious women often don't know as much about men as they should? She said, because they've never been taught by man, by anyone but their mothers, who often knew very little themselves. Women who know how a man thinks are those who have been taught by a man. Jeff Pollard, in his book again on the Christian modesty and public undressing of America, he says, above all, we men must learn how to govern our hearts and eyes, as well as to teach our wives and children the proper principles of modesty. Although women are vulnerable to wearing lavish or sensual apparel, their fathers and husbands are ultimately responsible for what the women in their homes wear. We have got to teach them. We have got to tell them, this is how a man thinks. You need to be aware of that. Fathers need to teach their wives and their daughters. Elders need to instruct the women in the local congregation. Preachers need to teach on this, and they need to not just lay out the principles, but the practice of modesty. And the fact that this applies to weddings and wedding dresses and kind of the bridesmaids' dresses. This applies to sports and sports uniforms. This applies to sporting events, to recreation, to any other activity. It's not just a, well, when you're not doing anything else, well, that's just the way that the uniform is. That's just the way that everybody looks at it that way. Well, you're not like just everybody else. The matter of modesty applies everywhere. And men and women need to, or men need to be able to teach this. But I want a real quick look at this, and then the lesson will be yours. Sometimes people say, well, you just hit the women all the time. Does modesty and dress apply to men? And here's what gets said. Well, New Testament scriptures on dress are only addressed to women and not men. You gave 1 Timothy chapter 2. You gave 1 Peter chapter 3. Both those are addressed to women, not men. It's men who are warned about lusting, not women. And so then, therefore, women or men won't ever create a problem for a woman, is the supposition. I want you to consider something, that if this is true, then there would be no scripture ever addressing the matter of nakedness regarding a man. That wouldn't be an issue, because modesty wouldn't apply to a man. And there'd be no issues or no scriptures regarding a man needing to be covered, because if it's just a woman issue, then there wouldn't be any scriptures wherein we find nakedness being applied to a man. And yet that's simply not the case. In Genesis chapter 2 and verse 25, both were naked and were not ashamed. Someone says, but this shame is just reference to their innocence in regards to sin. Okay. Genesis 3 and verse 7. Knew that they were both naked and made loin coverings. They knew that they were both naked. Someone says, well, this is just their attempt to cover their guilt with clothes. Okay, there may be some truth to that. Is that all that there is? God made garments of skin and clothed them. Are you going to tell me that that's some spiritual application, or that God said this is how it's going to have to be in this sin-cursed world? This is what's going to need to be covered. What about this? Is it covering guilt, or is it covering their bodies? In Genesis chapter 9, verses 20 and 25, there are other things that might be said about this passage, and there are other things that we might, implications of this passage, but all that we're trying to find is nakedness ever applied to a man? Is that an issue for a man? Because that's one of the issues of modesty. And we find in Genesis chapter 9 and verse 22 that Ham saw the nakedness of his father. His other two sons covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness. In Exodus chapter 20 and verse 26, no high altar, so that your nakedness will not be exposed. Women weren't priests, it was men. The priests were to wear these breeches so that they would cover their bare flesh. In Luke chapter 8, verses 27 through 36, the story of the demon-possessed man. It's interesting that in verse 27, here's a man who had not put on clothing for a long time. He was not in his right mind because he was demon-possessed. But later when Jesus throws out the demon, now he is in his right mind. But notice what's attached to that as well. He's clothed and in his right mind. As if to suggest the fact that he was naked demonstrated that he was not in his right mind. But now he's in his right mind, and I know that because he's clothed. It is an issue for men. And then in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9, as well as 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2, you notice that when I read that definition for zodiates on that particular Greek word, that it always was from the male perspective. There's a reason for that, because zodiates is actually defining the word in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2. But it's the same word in reference to the qualifications of elders. It's the same exact word, that kosmaios, as is found in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 9. And Zodiades himself says that this word means not only the propriety of his dress and demeanor, but of his inner life. Yes, it is an issue. In Matthew chapter 5, verses 28 through 30, yes, that is addressed to the matter of lust, of a man lusting after a woman. It is addressed to men. That is who Jesus was speaking to. But don't tell me that lust is not an issue for women. In fact, it was interesting, a brother in the preacher's gathering on Monday suggested that it's becoming more and more of an issue in our society with regards to women. How do you explain the popularity of the Chippendales male dancers or any other kind of sexually charged activity that women can go to? Because lust is also an issue for women. And so if lust is an issue for them, may not be to the extent that it is to men, but if it is also an issue for women, then shouldn't we as men make sure that we're not dressing in such a way that would cause lust in their hearts as they're striving to serve God? And so obviously then, modesty does apply to men. Absolutely. Does God care how we dress? Absolutely. Now you can take your songbooks out and turn it to the number that's been suggested. You've been so kind to pay such good attention. And I've tried to go through this as quickly and effectively as I could. This is an issue that we have to make not just the principles clear of modesty, but we have to be clear about the application of modesty. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5 that if your right hand causes you a difficulty, causes offense, it would be better for you to cut it off than to go through life and to go through life maimed than to lose your soul in hell. I would suggest to you this evening that if you can never wear the fashions of today, if that's the cross that you must bear, it would be better for you to go through life being accused of being a fuddy-dud, being accused of being out of date, being accused of being whatever derogatory term that might be leveled against you. It would be better for you to go through life carrying that kind of a baggage than to lose your soul in hell because you didn't understand the nakedness issue, were oblivious to the lust issue, and your heart was not right. There's nothing worth giving up heaven for. And brethren, I'm telling you, your clothing is certainly not worth giving up for heaven. If you're here this evening, your life is not what it needs to be, and we can help you make it right, let us know. Come forward while together we stand and sing.